Welcome to Behind the Ticker. I'm Brad Roth, Chief Investment Officer of Thor Financial Technologies and Portfolio Manager of THLV, the Thor Low Volatility ETF. Behind the Ticker uncovers the inner workings of the ETF industry. We will interview portfolio managers and ETF service providers to dive deep into their work lives and their businesses. We will learn the inner workings of their strategies and what drives them as they continue to grow their company. Many of these individuals are entrepreneurs and will have unique and compelling insights to share as much goes on behind the ticker. Please note, nothing in this show is investment advice, and it is meant solely for educational and entertainment purposes only.
Welcome to Behind the Ticker. My name is Ellery Roth, Brad Roth's daughter. I hope you enjoy this episode with Mr. Jason Hsu.
Welcome to Behind the Ticker. Thank you, Ellery. She has been begging me to do the introduction. She would love to hear her voice on Spotify, so we slipped her in a quick introduction there for Mr. Jason Hsu. He is from Rayliant. They just launched their Japan equity ETF, ticker RAYJ. It's a concentrated portfolio of 30 growth names. They use a fundamental as well as quantitative approach to build the portfolio. I think it's a unique story. I think it's great timing with international being so depressed in terms of valuation versus the U.S. from a historical basis. So we talk about the firm, we talk about the product, and we talk kind of briefly. They have a handful of other ETFs. So without further ado, I think you'll enjoy this conversation with Mr. Jason Hsu. Hey, Jason, welcome to the show.
Hi, Brad. Glad to be on the show.
So can you give everybody kind of your background and how you got into the position where you are today?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I actually started out as an academic in the university, but thought, hey, you know, all these things that we're teaching, do they actually work? And so I actually built a very successful institutional business around quantitative research that we've developed in academia. And since then, I've taken the institutional business and also created retail vehicles. So now all of our strategies are available in active ETFs.
So I always like to ask before we get into the business, what kind of hobbies you like to get into when you're outside of work and you're not, you know, behind the desk?
I guess, you know, my hobby is watching basketball games. I actually played in high school and played a little bit in college. I went to Caltech, so it's not hard to play college basketball at Caltech. And basically, if you had legs, you could play. But I love basketball. Grew up on, you know, the Lakers versus the Celtics, right? The days of Magic Johnson and Larry Bird. So that's my passion.
No, that's great. That's what we were just talking before we got on the show, basketball and hockey. Well, did basketball playoffs start yet, or is it just hockey right now?
No, it's game two already.
Okay. Yeah. Happens fast. So I'm in Pittsburgh. We don't have a basketball team, but at least we have the rest of the sports. So we have the Penguins. So let's talk about Rayliant, right? We know you have a handful of ETFs. We're going to talk about a few of those today. But can you talk about some of the other things you do and how you're helping clients kind of holistically other than just in the ETF space?
Well, absolutely. So as I mentioned, we are primarily institutional. So we run money for the governments of Japan, Taiwan, Canada. We run pension funds as well as sovereign wealth funds. So that's kind of our primary client segment up until recently. And so in the wealth space, in kind of the retail financial advisor space, we now offer model portfolios containing ETFs or direct stocks in the model portfolios. And of course, we also manufacture the tools, which are some of the ETFs that aren't as available in terms of the universe of ETFs. So you'll see that we are coming to markets with, you know, sort of nichier active ETFs in emerging markets, emerging ex-China, China, and now Japan.
Yeah, so you started the business, if I read correctly, in 2016. You guys have a significant amount of AUA. I'm assuming a lot of that's driven by your institutional work. You have a lot of different channels. Can you talk about really what made you start the business? I know you came from academia and eventually how you kind of scaled it to where you got it today.
Yeah. So we actually spun out of a larger organization. So when I first spun out of academia and launched my funds management business, my first startup is Research Affiliates. So I co-founded that firm with Rob Arnott, built out this franchise, the RAFI, or Fundamental Index franchise, and then had my second spin out in 2016, basically spun out of Research Affiliates and kind of taken over what was Research Affiliates Asia, and kind of from that platform started offering institutional services primarily in niche markets, like emerging Asia and single country, I would say Asian economies. And then, you know, I think broadening that out since then.
Yeah. So I saw the word quantamental a lot on the website. I'm a big fan of this type of investing. We have a lot of financial advisors that listen to the show. So can you talk about what that means to your firm in particular and how you're implementing it?
Sure. So I would say, even though I am quantitative in my DNA, it doesn't mean black box, right? I have tremendous amount of respect for stock pickers, for people who are qualitative, fundamental, but really deep dive stock pickers. And in fact, a lot of what we're trying to do using the quantitative methods is, what can we model what a really experienced stock picker actually do day in, day out basis? Just do it systematically, take out the human emotions and human biases. And of course, with machines, you can broadly apply the same methodology to, you know, a universe of 10,000, 20,000 global stocks. So that's kind of how I think about the right way to do quantitative analysis, is to really use systematic computer sort of science methodology to, as much as possible, replicate what a human portfolio manager and human analyst can do. But of course, we also want to, you know, hire experienced human portfolio managers who then will look at the output of the computer, not just blindly trust the machine, but make sure that there's a layer of sanity check or a layer of risk management, especially risk managing against events that don't currently live in the data, right? Because there are just a lot of new events that we're facing right now that you can't honestly say, oh, that's happened historically, so we have some data to guide us.
Yeah. And so you kind of answered my next question, which is how much human interaction goes in it. I mean, we run a systematic and quantitative portfolio. We don't put a lot of human overlay on it other than some guardrails for it. So it sounds like to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, if you're kind of having humans almost fact check the model in a way that you kind of know what's coming on the horizon and whether or not a certain investment or a certain amount of risk may or may not be necessary.
I think guardrail is the perfect word for it, because what you don't want is, you don't want the human to come in and say, oh, you know, I disagree with the machine, I have some other insight that I want to implement, right? Because, you know, the thesis is, we believe in the human insight and the human framework, and we have done as much as we can using models to replicate that. So I think the human's role in this case is to say, look, if the human insights live there, let's make sure the output matches that insight, that you don't have unexplainable trades or large concentrated positions that you can't really map back to that intuition.
Yeah. So let's talk about, you know, you have four ETFs that I've seen come to market. We want to talk about RAYJ, which is RAYJ, which is your Japan equity ETF. So if you could, can you please just explain the strategy at a very high level and what it's trying to accomplish?
Sure. And you know, obviously, RAYJ is, you know, Rayliant Japan. Sounds like Raymond James, but it's actually in collaboration with one of the largest financial institutions in Japan. So it's in collaboration with the Sumitomo Group. Of course, they're the, you know, largest insurance, banking, investment management conglomerate in Japan. So partnering with them is really what I think the ideal combination of taking the quantitative science and the fundamental, because they're a big stock picker shop. They obviously been in business for as long as I think the Japanese stock market's been available. And so we are working with their portfolio managers to take what we think is a more interesting segment of Japan that people don't talk about. It's really the small mid-cap segment. Now, occasionally we'll have larger cap names, but primarily a focus in the small mid-cap segment. They offer their deep fundamental research, and we give to them the quantitative scoring of the stocks. And it's really the combination of the two that then results in a final portfolio. So it's a very unique beta, right? Most people think of Japan as, you know, buying things that's in the Nikkei, or buying things that are the Toyotas, the, you know, Sumitomo, the Nomuras. Instead, we're looking at a segment where you kind of rarely come into contact with these smaller names. They just aren't globally covered by analysts.
Yeah. So I definitely want to talk about kind of that screening process. I see the fund is fairly concentrated. So I looked at the fact sheet, at least the last fact sheet shows about 30 names in the portfolio. Can you talk about that screening process? I know you touched on it there a little bit, but maybe how you're getting to that, to those 30 names. And then afterwards, we'll talk about kind of how you make weighting decisions around those names.
Yeah. So the screens that we apply broadly fall into, I would say, three distinct categories. And within each categories, they're sort of, you know, separate dimensions. So the three distinct categories is we clearly focus on the fundamental. So we care a lot about, you know, so healthy, high quality fundamental, growth oriented fundamental. There's another category that's really about what the corporate insiders are doing and what you can infer from that. So it's, think of it as, you know, the governance structure. Think of it as, are the insiders buying? Think of it, has there been evidence of insider manipulating, managing earnings aggressively? So those who could all be sort of negative and positive signals that come into it, that comes from analyzing the insiders. And then the final piece is really understanding the market sentiment. And, you know, the Japanese market is actually still very retail oriented. About 30-35% of their trades is retail. So it's a fairly retail influence market. So we want to understand the, you know, what flows is conducted by the institutions, what flows conducted by retail. Retail tends to lose over time, so we certainly don't want to be trading in the same direction. We want to understand what the sentiment is, generally more positive, negative. So again, if there's a cheap value stock, you don't want to be catching a falling knife with negative sentiment that's strong. And you want to wait and see if there's sort of catalyst around a particular theme we're interested in. So these are the three distinct screening dimensions. And I would say on the fundamental side, what's particularly important is, you know, growth as a key, I would say, quality screen that we look at, because we were less interested in just buying a big dividend payer. We're interested in really accessing growth, especially we think, you know, Japanese recovery is for real. We want to have, you know, that growth exposure, the higher beta exposure. So quality as a screen, valuations as a screen are key, right? We want to buy growth at a reasonable price. And then you overlap on top of that sentiment to make sure that you're, you know, kind of at the right part of that growth curve. You don't have to wait years before the growth catalyst comes around.
Right. No, I definitely want to talk about more about market sentiment and how you're analyzing that. But as far as, you know, now, in my opinion, if you kind of just look at international historically compared to U.S. equities, I mean, you'd have to be excited about the growth projections and, you know, almost a reversion to the mean in terms of valuation in those sectors. Are you guys of the same belief?
Absolutely. So, and this is why we actually like emerging markets a lot. And in this case, I almost would say, you know, Japan has for a very long time behaved like an emerging market, right? It's always fairly cheap, right? You want the growth story, but it seems to be much more cyclical than structurally growing. But if you now look at, I would say, you know, from a cyclical perspective, it's probably at the cyclical trough. It's been cheap for a long time. If you look at kind of the growth trajectory, there are a lot of catalysts to believe in a structural recovery in Japan. And so this is why we really like Japan right now and are bringing a product to market, right? It's cheap. It's at cyclical bottom. But the growth catalyst seems so obvious with the really ultra cheap yen, with finally inflation coming back to that economy so they can normalize their interest rate, and households as a result of that are receiving a strong income to their, you know, bank deposit and to their, you know, network. So these are all really positive catalysts for that market.
Yeah, no, I would agree. So it's an exciting time to have this particular product in the market. Let's go back to sentiment, because I'm interested, right? How are you observing sentiment? Are you looking at flows? Are you using, and some, you know, I've talked to some managers that are using AI models to read sentiment on social. There's many different ways. So primarily, how are you trying to uncover where that retail and or institutional sentiment is?
Yeah, so I think sentiment is one area where the quantitative approach has an enormous advantage, because you could use AI to process text and from there just score whether, you know, media and headlines tends to be more growth oriented, more positive sentiment. Also, you could use that to look at tick by tick data and understand whether you're seeing sort of, you know, retail order flows that tends to be sentiment chasing, tends to react and amplify positive sentiments. And so we're using, you know, data and the machine learning methodology to access sentiment measures across all channels where there's data available.
Yeah. So with that, let's talk about weighting decisions, right? It is a fairly concentrated portfolio. It's not run equal weight. So when you're running and looking at certain weighting decisions, is that primarily driven by that market sentiment, or are there other things that you're looking at to kind of derive, you know, the amount of risk you're willing to take in any single one of those names?
I would say the primary weighting decisions are driven actually by the, you know, of the three buckets I talked about, it's primarily driven by the fundamental bucket that has the largest weight. You know, let's say that actually has 2/3 of the weight, because you want to anchor the portfolio in something you can believe in, that you want to hold for the next 5 years, the next 10 years, right? We will never get into a company that has poor fundamental just because the sentiment is positive, because that's a bit of a Ponzi scheme, right? You might trade perfectly and get out before things blow up, but that's, I think that's not how our investors want to invest. It's certainly not how we want to invest. So for us, it's about, we want to buy companies that have the right fundamental characteristics when it comes to growth, when it comes to other sort of quality aspect to it. We want the sentiment to be there so that, you know, oftentimes, you know, you can be in a really good fundamental company that remains undiscovered for years, right? And then that's just a poor use of capital. So we do want the sentiment to be there, and as a way to sort of ramp us up, because there are generally a lot of interesting companies that we would like to own. The one that has positive sentiment is the one that's more likely to immediately generate a return. So really, the anchor is the fundamental quality of the company. And I would say the sentiments, what the corporate insiders are doing, becomes catalyst that just predicts a faster return to capital.
Got it. So how often are you rebalancing the underlying, or is the fund purely active and you can kind of rebalance it at any time? I mean, how often are, or is there a, you know, a monthly, quarterly, weekly rebalance schedule? And on top of that, how often are you kind of rerunning the fundamentals and looking at the screen to add or delete any names that might be in the portfolio?
The fund is truly active. So there's not a sort of deterministic, like, oh, every month or every quarter we do something. As information comes through, you know, we'll be making, you know, rebalancing and making trades. Now, of course, a lot of the quantitative signals tend to be more, you know, on a cycle, right? Monthly cycle for some of the data, quarterly cycle for a lot of the sort of fundamental earnings related data. So there is a updating cycle that produces a new set of screens and scores. But then remember, that goes to the active managers in Japan who use that as part of decision criteria to put together a portfolio. And they have sort of ongoing monitoring of news, of reviewing with the actual company in terms of manager visits that then all result in the final portfolio. So I would say trading can occur at any point in time. You know, some of the information is a bit more, I would say, chunky as they get released every quarter.
So when all last question on kind of the underlying holdings and weighting, do you have any guardrails on sector exposure, or can you really go anywhere in terms of, you know, the names that you want to put in here? Like, do you have any guardrails around, you need so much exposure to financials or information technology, or can you really just take this anywhere and find the best ideas?
We have some guardrail, but those guardrail are very loose, because we do believe in, look, you know, the underlying benchmark has these sector weights. Now, do they make any sense? Is there a reason why finances has to be, you know, 20%+ for Japan simply because they have these big old financial dinosaurs, right? So for us, we want to take active deviations against what's in the cap weighted benchmark. I've always been a big believer in that, especially in the market where you can't, you know, say, oh, the index, the passive index is perfectly efficient. So we do take quite a bit of deviation in the active Japan product, which is why it's more concentrated, reflecting the fact that it is also a more inefficient market, a market where the underlying index is dominated by, I would say, firms that haven't grown and firms that probably aren't going to be the one that delivers future returns.
Yeah. So as a model portfolio builder yourself, or as somebody that you're talking to, you know, an advisor group that might have their own model portfolios, where would you put RAYJ as a allocation? Kind of what bucket would you put it in? How would you weight it? You know, just kind of best practices to use the fund.
Yeah. So definitely this goes into your kind of international developed bucket. And we've been telling a lot of clients, like, you know, within your IFA bucket, right, your international ex-US bucket, frankly, when you look at what's available there and the thesis, you're probably not too excited, right? Is it the UK, which is still probably struggling with the Brexit? And then I think, you know, the pound, the inflation, the inability to raise rate like we did in the US to fight off inflation. Eurozone isn't, I think, any better versus the UK. So in some ways, if you're looking at international ex-US, I actually like Japan more than anything else, right? It's cheaper. It's got that growth story. It loves inflation, wants inflation, rather than it's trying to fight it or it's being harmed by it, right? So it has a almost opposite macro of the rest of IFA. So I would underweight within my international portfolio Europe and meaningfully overweight Japan. That's I would almost make it 50-50, right? You know, Japan might be, say, 20-odd%, maybe close to 30% of IFA, but I would definitely probably bring that up to closer to 50% and then downweight Europe.
Got it. Makes sense to me. So as a new fund, or I should say as a new issue that you guys have out there, I always like to ask how you think about marketing the fund, right? It's one thing to come up with the idea, do all of the work and produce good results for your clients and those who use it. But how are you guys thinking about marketing and getting RAYJ out there and people starting to implement it in their portfolios?
First of all, I'm going to go on every single podcast interview wearing a Hello Kitty t-shirt. Everyone knows Hello Kitty, right? We probably know Hello Kitty as much as we know, Toyota Prius. But how do you access Toyota Prius? You buy Toyota, right? It's one of the largest cap name, but how would you access Hello Kitty? You probably don't know the company that owns the brand and licensing, right? And it's a fast growing, very interesting, mid-cap company in Japan. So, we're out there talking to all the advisors. We are at different conferences, making sure people understand kind of our brand energy, what we're bringing to market, right? It tends to be some niche, interesting growth markets that people don't talk about that perhaps is more blue ocean than red ocean in terms of competition. And we do a lot of, I would say, investor education, advisor education, just helping people to understand how does Japan make sense, right? How does, say, China make sense in your portfolio? How does emerging ex-China make sense in your portfolio? So these are sort of niche topics, one where there isn't a lot of education, but one I think we excel in terms of helping advisors understand where to put this in a model portfolio.
Yeah. Well, Jason, I really appreciate your time. This was a lot of fun. Before I let you go, where can people learn more about this fund? Where can they learn more about your firm and get some of that information that you were talking about?
Absolutely. So first of all, please do find me on LinkedIn. That is the primary social media platform that I use and my firm use. So go on LinkedIn, find me and add me as your connection, and then add my newsletter, The Bridge. And the idea is to bridge these less familiar markets with the U.S. advisors. So you have a steady source of both op-ed and research pieces coming from my firm. And then go to funds.raylian.com to get the prospectus for our different ETFs.
Well, again, thank you so much. I hope to see you on the conference trail. And I really appreciate your time in doing this.
Thanks, Brad.